Section 5 of The Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath by Howard Phillips Lovecraft. Read by Martin Rato. Carter now outlined the peril of the cat tribe, and was rewarded by deep-throated purrs of gratitude from all sides. Consulting with the generals, he prepared a plan of instant action which involved marching at once upon the Zug Council and other known strongholds of Zugs, forestalling their surprise attacks and forcing them to terms before the mobilization of their army of invasion. Thereupon, without a moment's loss, that great ocean of cats flooded the enchanted wood and surged around the council tree and the great stone circle. Flutterings rose to panic pitch as the enemy saw the newcomers, and there was very little resistance among the furtive and curious brown Zugs. They saw that they were beaten in advance and turned from thoughts of vengeance to thoughts of present self-preservation. Half the cats now seated themselves in a circular formation with the captured Zugs in the center, leaving open a lane down which were marched the additional captives rounded up by the other cats in other parts of the wood. Terms were discussed at length, Carter acting as interpreter, and it was decided that the Zugs might remain a free tribe on condition of rendering to the cats a large tribute of grouse, quail, and pheasants from the less fabulous parts of the forest. 12 young Zugs of noble families were taken as hostages to be kept in the Temple of Cats at Ulthar, and the victors made it plain that any disappearances of cats on the borders of the Zug domain would be followed by consequences highly disastrous to Zugs. These matters disposed of, the assembled cats broke ranks and permitted the Zugs to slink off one by one to their respective homes, which they hastened to do with many a sullen backward glance. The old cat general now offered Carter an escort through the forest to whatever border he wished to reach, deeming it likely that the Zugs would harbor dire resentment against him for the frustration of their warlike enterprise. This offer he welcomed with gratitude, not only for the safety it afforded, but because he liked the graceful companionship of cats. So in the midst of a pleasant and playful regiment, relaxed after the successful performance of its duty, Randolph Carter walked with dignity through that enchanted and phosphorescent wood of Titan trees, talking of his quest with the old general and his grandson, whilst others of the band indulged in fantastic gambols or chased fallen leaves that the wind drove among the fungi of that primeval floor. And the old cat said that he had heard much of unknown Kadath in the cold waste, but did not know where it was. As for the marvelous Sunset City, he had not even heard of that, but would gladly relay to Carter anything he might later learn. He gave the seeker some passwords of great value among the cats of Dreamland, and commended him especially to the old chief of the cats in Celephais, whither he was bound. That old cat, already slightly known to Carter, was a dignified Maltese, and would prove highly influential in any transaction. It was dawn when they came to the proper edge of the wood, and Carter bade his friends a reluctant farewell. The young sub-lieutenant he had met as a small kitten would have followed him had not the old general forbidden it. But that austere patriarch insisted that the path of duty lay with the tribe and the army. So Carter set out alone over the golden fields that stretched mysterious beside a willow-fringed river, and the cats went back into the wood. Well did the traveler know those garden lands that lie betwixt the wood of the Serenarian Sea, and blithely did he follow the singing river Ukianos that marked his course. The sun rose higher over gentle slopes of grove and lawn, and heightened the colors of the thousand flowers that starred each knoll and dangle. A blessed haze lies upon all this region, wherein is held a little more of the sunlight than other places hold, and a little more of the summer's humming music of birds and bees, so that men walk through it as through a fairy place, and feel greater joy and wonder than they ever afterward remember. By noon, Carter reached the jasper terraces of Curran, which slope down to the river's edge and bear that temple of loveliness wherein the king of Ilekvad comes from his far realm on the twilight sea once a year in a golden palanquin to pray to the god of Ukianos, who sang to him in youth when he dwelt in a cottage by its banks. All of jasper is that temple, and covering an acre of ground with its walls and courts, its seven pinnacled towers, and its inner shrine where the river enters through hidden channels and the god sings softly in the night. Many times the moon hears strange music as it shines on those courts and terraces and pinnacles, but whether that music be the song of the god or the chant of the cryptical priests, none but the king of Ilekvad may say, for only he had entered the temple or seen the priests. Now, in the drowsiness of day, that carven and delicate fane was silent, and Carter heard only the murmur of the great stream and the hum of the birds and bees as he walked onward under the enchanted sun. All that afternoon the pilgrim wandered on through perfumed meadows, and in the lee of gentle riverward hills bearing peaceful thatched cottages and the shrines of amiable gods carven from jasper or chrysoberyl. Sometimes he walked close to the bank of Ukianos and whistled to the sprightly and iridescent fish of that crystal stream, and at other times he paused amidst the whispering rushes and gazed at the dark wood on the farther side, whose trees came down clear to the water's edge. In former dreams he had seen quaint lumbering bupaths come shyly out of that wood to drink, but now he could not glimpse any. Once in a while he paused to watch a carnivorous fish catch a fishing bird, which it lured to the water by showing its tempting scales in the sun, and grasped by the beak with its enormous mouth as the winged hunter sought to dart down upon it. Toward evening he mounted a low grassy rise and saw before him flaming in the sunset the thousand gilded spires of Thran. Lofty beyond belief are the alabaster walls of that incredible city, sloping inward toward the top and wrought in one solid piece by what means no man knows, for they are more ancient than memory. Yet lofty as they are, with their 100 gates and 200 turrets, the clustered towers within, all white beneath their golden spires, are loftier still, so that men on the plain around see them soaring into the sky, sometimes shining clear, sometimes caught at the top in tangles of cloud and mist, and sometimes clouded lower down with their utmost pinnacles blazing free above the vapors. And where Thran's gates open on the river are great wharves of marble, with ornate galleons of fragrant cedar and calamander riding gently at anchor, and strange bearded sailors sitting on casks and bales with the hieroglyphs of far places. Landward beyond the walls lies the farm country, where small white cottages dream between little hills, and narrow roads with many stone bridges wind gracefully among the streams and gardens. Down through this verdant land Carter walked at evening, and saw twilight float up from the river to the marvelous golden spires of Thran. And just at the hour of dusk he came to the southern gate, and was stopped by a red-robed sentry till he had told three dreams beyond belief, and proved himself a dreamer worthy to walk up Thran's steep, mysterious streets, and linger in the bazaars where the wares of the ornate galleons were sold. Then into that incredible city he walked, through a wall so thick that the gate was a tunnel, and thereafter, amidst curved and undulant ways winding deep and narrow between the heavenward towers, lights shone through grated and balconied windows, and the sound of lutes and pipes stole timid from inner courts where marble fountains bubbled. Carter knew his way and edged down through darker streets to the river, where at an old sea tavern he found the captains and seamen he had known in myriad other dreams. There he bought his passage to Celephice on a great green galleon, and there he stopped for the night after speaking gravely to the venerable cat of that inn, who blinked dozing before an enormous hearth and dreamed of old wars and forgotten gods. In the morning, Carter boarded the galleon bound for Celephice and sat in the prow as the ropes were cast off and the long sail down to the Serenarian Sea began. For many leagues the banks were much as they were above Thrawn, with now and then a curious temple rising on the farther hills toward the right, and a drowsy village on the shore with steep red roofs and nets spread in the sun. Mindful of his search, Carter questioned all the mariners closely about those whom they'd met at the taverns of Celephice, asking the names and ways of the strange men with long, narrow eyes, long-lobed ears, thin noses, and pointed chins, who came in dark ships from the north and traded onyx for the carved jade and spun gold and little red singing birds of Celephice. Of these men the sailors knew not much, save that they talked but seldom, and spread a kind of awe about them. Their land, very far away, was called Inquinoch, and not many people cared to go thither because it was a cold twilight land and set to be close to unpleasant Lang. Although high, impassable mountains towered on the side where Lang was thought to lie, so that none might say whether this evil plateau with its horrible stone villages and unmentionable monastery were really there, or whether the rumor were only a fear that timid people felt in the night when those formidable barrier peaks loomed black against a rising moon. Certainly men reached Lang from very different oceans. Of other boundaries of Inquinoch those sailors had no notion, nor had they heard of the cold waste and unknown Kadath, save from vague, unplaced report. And of the marvelous sunset city which Carter sought they knew nothing at all. So the traveler asked no more of far things, but bided his time till he might talk with those strange men from cold and twilight Inquinoch, who were the seed of such gods as carved their features on Angronic. Late in the day, the galleon reached those bends of the river which traverse the perfumed jungles of Kiant. Here Carter wished he might disembark, for in those tropic tangles sleep wondrous palaces of ivory, lone and unbroken, where once dwelt fabulous monarchs of a land whose name is forgotten. Spells of the Elder Ones keep those places unharmed and undecayed, for it is written that there may one day be need of them again, and elephant caravans have glimpsed them from afar by moonlight, though none dares approach them closely because of the guardians to which their wholeness is due. But the ship swept on, and dusk hushed the hum of the day, and the first stars above blinked answers to the early fireflies on the banks as that jungle fell far behind, leaving only its fragrance as a memory that it had been. And all through the night that galleon floated on past mysteries unseen and unsuspected. Once a lookout reported fires on the hills to the east, but the sleepy captain said they'd better not be looked at too much, since it was highly uncertain just who or what had lit them. In the morning, the river had broadened out greatly, and Carter saw by the houses along the banks that they were close to the vast trading city of Llanath on the Serenarian Sea. Here the walls are of rugged granite, and the houses peakedly fantastic with beamed and plastered gables. The men of Llanath are more like those of the waking world than any others in Dreamland, so that the city is not sought except for barter, but is prized for the solid work of its artisans. The wharves of Llanath are of oak, and there the galleon made fast while the captain traded in the taverns. Carter also went ashore and looked curiously upon the rutted streets where wooden ox carts lumbered and feverish merchants cried their wares vacuously in the bazaars. The sea taverns were all close to the wharves on cobbled lanes salted with the spray of high tides and seemed exceedingly ancient with their low black-beamed ceilings and casements of greenish bullseye panes. Ancient sailors in those taverns talked much of distant ports and told many stories of the curious men from Twilight Inquinoch, but had little to add to what the seamen of the galleon had told. Then at last, after much unloading and loading, the ship set sail once more over the sunset sea, and the high walls and gables of Llanath grew less as the last golden light of day lent them a wonder and beauty beyond any that men had given them. 2 nights and 2 days the galleon sailed over the Serenarian Sea, sighting no land and speaking but one other vessel. Then, near sunset of the second day, there loomed up ahead the snowy peak of Aran, with its ginkgo trees swaying on the lower slope, and Carter knew that they were come to the land of Uthnargai and the marvelous city of Seliphice. Swiftly there came into sight the glittering minarets of that fabulous town, and the untarnished marble walls with their bronze statues, and the great stone bridge where Naraxa joins the sea. Then rose the gentle hills behind the town, with their groves and gardens of asphodels and small shrines and cottages upon them, and far in the background the purple ridge of the Tenarians, potent and mystical, behind which lay forbidden ways into the waking world and toward other regions of dream. The harbor was full of painted galleys, some of which were from the marble cloud city of Serenian that lies in ethereal space beyond where the sea meets the sky, and some of which were from more substantial parts of Dreamland. Among these, the steersman threaded his way up to the spice-fragrant wharves, where the galleon made fast in the dusk as the city's million lights began to twinkle out over the water. Ever new seemed this deathless city of vision, for here time has no power to tarnish or destroy. As it has always been, is still the turquoise of Noth Horthoth, and the 80 orchid-weathered priests are the same who builded it 10,000 years ago. Shining still is the bronze of the great gates, nor are the onyx pavements ever worn or broken. And the great bronze statues on the walls look down on merchants and camel drivers older than fable, yet without one gray hair in their forked beards. Carter did not once seek out the temple, or the palace, or the citadel, but stayed by the seaward wall among traders and sailors. And when it was too late for rumors and legends, he sought out an ancient tavern he knew well, and rested with dreams of the gods on unknown Kadath whom he sought. The next day he searched all along the quays for some of the strange mariners of Inquinoch, but was told that none were now in port, their galley not being due from the north for full 2 weeks. He found, however, one Thorabonian sailor who'd been to Inquinoch and had worked in the onyx quarries of that twilight place, and this sailor said there was certainly a descent to the north of the peopled region, which everybody seemed to fear and shun. the Thoribonian opined that this desert led around the utmost rim of impassable peaks into Lang's horrible plateau, and that this was why men feared it, though he admitted there were other vague tales of evil presences and nameless sentinels. Whether or not this could be the fabled waste wherein unknown Kadath stands, he did not know. But it seemed unlikely that those presences and sentinels, if indeed they existed, were stationed for naught. On the following day, Carter walked up the Street of the Pillars to the Turquoise Temple and talked with the High Priest. Though Nath Horthoth is chiefly worshipped in Seliphice, all the great ones are mentioned in diurnal prayers, and the priest was reasonably versed in their moods. Like Atal in distant Ulthar, he strongly advised against any attempts to see them, declaring that they are testy and capricious, and subject to strange protection from the mindless other gods from outside, whose soul and messenger is the crawling chaos Nyarlathotep. Their jealous hiding of the marvelous sunset city showed clearly that they did not wish Carter to reach it, and it was doubtful how they would regard a guest whose object was to see them and plead before them. No man had ever found Kadath in the past, and it might be just as well if none ever found it in the future. Such rumors as were told about that onyx castle of the Great Ones were not by any means reassuring. Having thanked the orchid-crowned High Priest, Carter left the temple and sought out the bazaar of the sheep butchers, where the old chief of Seliphi's cats dwelt sleek and contented. That gray and dignified being was sunning himself on the onyx pavement and extended a languid paw as his caller approached. But when Carter repeated the passwords and introductions furnished him by the old cat general of Ulthar, the furry patriarch became very cordial and communicative, and told much of the secret lore known to cats on the seaward slopes of Uthnargai. Best of all, he repeated several things told him furtively by the timid waterfront cats of Seliphice about the men of Inquinoc, on whose dark ships no cat will go. It seems that these men have an aura not of earth about them. Though that is not the reason why no cat will sail on their ships. The reason for this is that Inquinoc holds shadows which no cat can endure, so that in all that cold twilight realm there is never a cheering purr or a homely mew. Whether it be because of things wafted over the impassable peaks from hypothetical Lang, or because of things filtering down from the chilly desert to the north, none may say. But it remains a fact that in that far land there broods a hint of outer space which cats do not like, and to which they are more sensitive than men. Therefore they will not go on the dark ships that seek the basalt keys of Inquinoc. The old chief of the cats also told him where to find his friend King Curanus, who in Carter's latter dreams had reigned alternately in the Rose Crystal Palace of the 70 Delights at Seliphice and in the turreted cloud castle of sky-floating Saranian. It seemed that he could no more find content in those places, but had formed a mighty longing for the English cliffs and downlands of his boyhood, where in little dreaming villages England's old songs hover at evening behind lattice windows, and where grey church towers peep lovely through the verdure of distant valleys. He could not go back to these things in the waking world because his body was dead. But he'd done the next best thing and dreamed a small tract of such countryside in the region east of the city where meadows roll gracefully up from the sea cliffs to the foot of the Tenarian Hills. There he dwelt in a grey Gothic manor house of stone looking on the sea, and tried to think it was ancient Trevor Towers, where he was born and where 13 generations of his forefathers had first seen the light. And on the coast nearby he'd built a little Cornish fishing village with steep cobbled ways settling therein such people as had the most English faces, and seeking ever to teach them the dear remembered accents of old Cornwall fishers. And in a valley not far off, he'd reared a great Norman abbey whose tower he could see from his window, placing around it in the churchyard gray stones with the names of his ancestors carved thereon, and with a moss somewhat like old England's moss. For though Coranus was a monarch in the land of dream, with all imagined pomps and marvels, splendors and beauties, ecstasies and delights, novelties and excitements at his command, he would gladly have resigned forever the whole of his power and luxury and freedom for one blessed day as a simple boy in that pure and quiet England, that ancient beloved England which had molded his being and of which he must always be immutably a part. So when Carter bade that old great chief of the cats adieu, he did not seek the terraced palace of rose crystal, but walked out the eastern gate and across the daisied fields toward a peaked gable which he glimpsed through the oaks of a park sloping up to the sea cliffs. And in time he came to a great hedge and a gate with a little brick lodge, and when he rang the bell there hobbled to admit him no robed and anointed lackey of the palace, but a small stubby old man in a smock, who spoke as best he could in the quaint tones of far Cornwall. And Carter walked up the shady path between trees as near as possible to England's trees, and climbed the terraces among gardens, set out as in Queen Anne's time. At the door, flanked by stone cats in the old way, he was met by a whiskered butler in suitable livery, and was presently taken to the library where Coranus, Lord of Uthnargai and the sky around Saranian, sat pensive in a chair by the window, looking on his little sea-coast village, and wishing that his old nurse would come in and scold him because he was not ready for that hateful lawn party at the vicar's, with the carriage waiting and his mother nearly out of patience. Coranus, clad in a dressing gown of the sort favored by London tailors in his youth, rose eagerly to meet his guest, for the sight of an Anglo-Saxon from the waking world was very dear to him, even if it was a Saxon from Boston, Massachusetts, instead of from Cornwall, and for long they talked of old times, having much to say, because both were old dreamers and well versed in the wonders of incredible places. Coranus, indeed, had been out beyond the stars in the ultimate void, and was set to be the only one who'd ever returned sane from such a voyage. At length Carter brought up the subject of his guest, and asked of his host those questions he had asked of so many others. Coranus did not know where Kadath was, or the marvelous Sunset City, but he did know that the Great Ones were very dangerous creatures to seek out, and that the other gods had strange ways of protecting them from impertinent curiosity. He had learned much of the other gods in distant parts of space, especially in that region where form does not exist and colored gases study the innermost secrets. The violet gas, Sngak, had told him terrible things of the crawling chaos Nyarlathotep, and had warned him never to approach the central void where the demon Sultan Azathoth gnaws hungrily in the dark. Altogether, it was not well to meddle with the Elder Ones, and if they persistently denied all access to the marvelous Sunset City, it were better not to seek that city. Coranus furthermore doubted whether his guest would profit aught by coming to the city, even were he to gain it. He himself had dreamed and yearned long years for lovely Celephice and the land of Uthnargai, and for the freedom and color and high experience of life devoid of its chains and conventions and stupidities. But now that he was come into that city and that land, and was the king thereof, he found the freedom and the vividness all too soon worn out and monotonous, for want of linkage with anything firm in his feelings and memories. He was a king in Uthnargai, but found no meaning therein, and drooped always for the old familiar things of England that had shaped his youth. All his kingdom would he give for the sound of Cornish church bells over the downs, and all the thousand minarets of Selifies for the steep, homely roofs of the village near his home. So he told his guests that the unknown Sunset City might not hold quite that content he sought, and that perhaps it had better remain a glorious and half-remembered dream. For he had visited Carter often in the old waking days, and knew well the lovely New England slopes that had given him birth. At the last, he was very certain the seeker would long only for the early remembered scenes. The glow of Beacon Hill at evening, the tall steeples and winding hill streets of quaint Kingsport, the hoary gambrel roofs of ancient and witch-haunted Arkham, and the blessed meads and valleys where stone walls rambled and white farmhouse gables peeped out from bowers of verdure. These things he told Randolph Carter, but still the seeker held to his purpose, and in the end they parted each with his own conviction, and Carter went back through the bronze gate into Selifies and down the street of pillars to the old sea wall, where he talked more with the mariners of far ports and waited for the dark ship from cold and twilight equinox, whose strange-faced sailors and onyx traders had in them the blood of the great ones.